This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat with Dr. Laura Shever about World AIDS Day and the progress being made for folks living with the disease. Then, native Mick Berry talks about his one-man show, which depicts the life story of the Who's drummer, Keith Moon. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans, but first... In celebration of the city's upcoming tricentennial, Nola V and New Orleans Historical bring you the series Who Did It Better? New Orleans Then and Now. It takes a look at offbeat aspects of the city's history and their parallels in the present day. Today, Renee Peck brings us to City Park in a segment she calls A Walk in the Park.
Celebration in the Oaks draws 165,000 visitors to City Park each holiday season. This year, it celebrates its 31st anniversary. Beginning the weekend after Thanksgiving and continuing to New Year's Day, visitors can walk through 500,000 lights and view installations such as the Cajun Night Before Christmas, prancing peacocks, a karaoke Santa, and a dripping snow tree that alone has 42,000 LED bulbs. But Celebration in the Oaks isn't City Park's first rodeo. For the past 160 years, this 1,300-acre space, half again as large as New York Central Park, has seen its share of notable happenings. Back then, the space played host to such New Orleans-centric events as daily duels beneath its stately oak trees, or later, nightly dancing under the stars at its neoclassical peristyle. Now you see more 21st-century affairs, like yoga and Pilates classes in the sculpture garden, or the loud and proud voodoo music experience. And an actual rodeo, too, this one of the fishing variety. Two 25-foot marble pylons called the Monteleon Gates lead to City Park from Esplanade Avenue. They're named after former City Park Commissioner Antonio Monteleon, who ran the famous French Quarter Hotel that bears his name. He also owned a local shoe factory that, in 1888, was turning out 500 pairs of shoes a week. A more romantic link between Monteleon and the park is the carousel. The one at his hotel is a rotating bar, while the flying horses at City Park are the real thing, and one of just 100 antique carousels left across the United States. To the left of the Monteleon gates lies an open grassy area where the Allard Plantation once stood. Louis Allard was a man of letters who was better at poetry and politics than raising sheep or sugarcane. He liked to sit under one of the famous dueling oaks and write poetry, and he asked to be buried there. So in 1847, he was laid to rest under the branches of the giant oak tree. A century later, when the grave was opened, there was no coffin to be found. To this day, no one knows what happened to Allard's body. The dueling oaks were just that, meeting places where disputes were resolved by sword or pistol. Before the Civil War, duels were fought almost daily under the oaks. Now, only one of the two giant trees remains. One was destroyed by a hurricane in the 1940s. The other is 70 feet high and thought to be 300 years old. That's nothing compared to some of its neighbors. City Park has one of the largest collections of mature oaks in the world, with the oldest rumored to be 800 years of age. New Orleans businessman John McDonough bought Allard's plantation at a sheriff's sale in 1947, and he left it to the city in his will. It was designated to City Park in 1859, but its history was really shaped by two later events, the Great Depression and Hurricane Katrina. The first led to the Works Progress Administration, which poured $12 million and 20,000 workers into a redo of the park. Almost a century later, Katrina left 95% of the park sitting in floodwaters, inflicting $43 million in damage. The public responded with an overwhelming outpouring of support that has funded not only repair, but also improvements. There's a new golf course, a mini golf course, 26 tennis courts, a new fishing pier, jogging, nature trails, and the 4-acre New Orleans City Park for dogs. In the past, people gathered at the park for their evening entertainment. Turn-of-the-century New Orleanians danced at the Peristyle from 6 to 11:30 each evening, or they headed over to Pop's Bandstand to watch pictures via the Vitascope, one of the first types of motion picture projectors. Now, people still gather at the park for their evening entertainment. They still watch outdoor movies, these days of the digital variety, and they still listen to live music under the stars at the Thursday night twilight concerts in the Botanical Garden. And, of course, they take in Celebration in the Oaks, with its one-of-a-kind holiday offerings from jingle bells and beer for the over 21 crowd to Mr. Bingle's upcoming 70th birthday party for the younger set. It's a far cry from pinning poetry under the dueling oaks, but Allard, I think, would approve. For more information about events at City Park, including Celebration in the Oaks, go to neworleanscitypark.com. Our thanks go to the University of New Orleans History Department and New Orleans Historical for research in this story. In New Orleans, I'm Renee Peck.
Good morning, evening, friend.
Friday is World AIDS Day, a day to show support to helping those who are living with the disease and remember those who have died from HIV and AIDS around the world. Joining me now to discuss the significance of World AIDS Day is Dr. Laura Shever, Associate Administrator for the Health Resources and Services Administration's HIV/AIDS Bureau. Dr. Shever, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Start by telling us your role with the Health Resources and Services Administration.
So within the Health Resources and Services Administration, I run the HIV/AIDS Bureau, and we administer the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. And that program provides comprehensive services in terms of primary care, essential support services, and medication for low-income people living with HIV in the U.S.
Could you share some information about that program and its significance to World AIDS Day?
Certainly. So the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program is based on a law that was passed in named in memory of Ryan White, who was a young teenager from Indiana who, when he was diagnosed with HIV related to blood products, wanted to be able to go to school, and he really fought hard to overcome discrimination and to help educate the United States and the general public about HIV and how it was transmitted. So in memory of him, when Congress passed the law to assure that we had services for low-income people living with HIV, they named it in memory of Ryan White.
Now, the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program just released the 2016 annual client-level data report. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So every year we do collect data on the success of the program and the effectiveness of the program, and we are releasing those data this week. The most important thing, I think, is that people living with HIV, if they can get onto treatment and stay on treatment and have an undetectable viral load, meaning they're successfully treated, they can live a near-normal lifespan, and people with an undetectable viral load are not going to be transmitting HIV sexually. So importantly, in the context of our program, which serves low-income people, we've improved our outcomes, our viral suppression rate, from about 70% of all people that were getting medical care and had at least one viral load checked in 2010, and we're now at 85% of all people that are in the program are virally suppressed today. So a huge improvement.
Yeah, a huge improvement. And you guys work with folks across the country, right?
Yes, we provide resources across the country. We do fund states, cities, and individual community-based organizations. Last year, we funded about $43.5 million in grants across the state of Louisiana.
Here in Louisiana, two of our major cities, New Orleans and Baton Rouge, top five for HIV. Let's talk a bit about that.
Yes, so HIV has been increasing in the South in recent years, and I would say that in Louisiana, you guys have been making tremendous progress in terms of combating the epidemic. The people working towards ending the epidemic in Louisiana, both in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and statewide, have done a great job. If you look across the state of Louisiana, We see that about 81.4% of people receiving services are virally suppressed, but that's a big improvement in the last few years. And in New Orleans, you're up to about 84% viral suppression rate, so really doing a great job.
Now, what more can you tell us about the progress that the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program has made in addressing the HIV epidemic here in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I think the key thing that's occurred in the last years is we've had a series of scientific breakthroughs that have really changed the way that we approach HIV. HIV now, if someone gets on their medication and takes them regularly, actually can live a near normal lifespan. And so the challenge we have is getting people into care and on treatment. And there are lots of challenges, regardless of what disease someone has, in terms of barriers to getting into care in the country. But the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, because we provide both medical care as well as essential support services like transportation to get to care and help covering medications, either providing medications or helping with co-pays and other financial barriers patients might have really made a significant improvement in getting people into care and remaining on treatment.
Now, how do you overcome those challenges?
Well, really, that is done by people at the local level, people that are working in community-based organizations in the cities and the counties and in the states, working with communities. In the Ryan White program, required by law that cities like New Orleans engage people living with HIV in their planning. So they're required to figure out where the gaps are in the city, where services are needed that aren't covered by other payers, and using the Ryan White funds to cover those, to fill those gaps. And it's highly effective.
What is your hope for the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program within the next couple of years?
We really are at a turning point in this country that we have the tools we need right now to end the HIV epidemic, to really stop new infections from occurring. But that requires us to get people who are HIV infected tested, and when they're tested and found to be positive, get them linked to care and help them remain in care. So across the nation, different jurisdictions, cities, and states are developing programs really aimed at ending the epidemic and using their resources differently to do that. And I think that can happen across the country, but we really need communities to be focused on that endpoint.
Lastly, Dr. Shever, why is World AIDS Day so important?
Yeah, World AIDS Day really provides us with a unique opportunity to reflect on the past and the future state of the epidemic and to highlight the work that needs to continue to be done. It's also a time to talk about the stigma and discrimination that still occurs around HIV/AIDS that really is a major barrier for patients. To have people living with HIV and their family and loved ones understand that this is a treatable disease and that if people get on treatment, they can live a long and productive life.
Dr. Laura Shever is the Associate Administrator for the Health Resources and Services Administration's HIV/AIDS Bureau. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you see the real me? Can you? Can you?
A native actor and drummer tells the musical story of the rise and fall of Keith Moon, the Who's original drummer and poster child of rock and roll bad boys. Joining me now to discuss this one-man show is writer and performer Mick Berry and director Nancy Carlin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Janae.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Mick, when did you pick up your first pair of drumsticks?
You know, I wanted to play at the age of three. And my parents, nah. By the age of 13, my father said, yeah, you can get drums if you buy them yourself. So I worked. My father ran Pelican Ice Company, And I worked one summer for $1.65 an hour, saved $350, bought my drums, and then I was off and running.
Wow. Now, folks who are familiar with Keith Moon know that he had what many call a self-destructive behavior, right?
Yeah.
How will that be portrayed in this show? And are there any other characteristics that we probably don't know about Keith Moon?
Yeah, well, the self-destructive behavior is really the theme of the show and how it got to be a burden for him, because he was so self-destructive it became his reputation, and he felt it was something he had to live up to. So not only did he have all of this alcoholism and drug taking and all of this horrible habits, but then it became his identity. So aside from giving him up, he felt he had to live up to it in order to fulfill the expectations of the fans.
And so, with that being said, I'd imagine that this show is rated R.
Yeah, that's about it. We try to keep it there, though. It doesn't go beyond R, but yeah.
Okay, so what else can folks expect from this show?
Well, he was a real prankster, and we put that in the show. The guy was, aside from having bad habits, he was hilarious. We put a lot of the things that he did. Like, there's one segment where they're checking into a hotel, desk phone rings, Keith answers it, and says to Pete Townsend, "It's for you." Townsend's in the elevator. He hands the phone to Pete Townsend. Elevator goes up. Cord snaps in two, and Pete shouts down, "Oh, I think I've been cut off." So
that's about the level of the sense of humor. He's gonna...
Yeah.
Wow. Now, Nancy, what inspired you to direct this show?
Well, Mick approached me about it, and this is a piece that Mick's been working on for quite some time, and but it appealed to me as a piece that brought drums down and center. You know, usually the drummer's up behind the band on a big stage in a rock and roll show. And I've seen other performers. I mean, I work primarily in theater, and there are piano players that come and do something, or guitar. There are other sort of singer-storyteller shows. But have you ever seen, you know, a drummer be the guy, you know, that's just drumming for you? You get to learn about drumming as well, which I think is really cool. From my perspective, and you know, I I'm of a similar age as Mick, and so it's just a cool time to think back on. But just trying to help Mick tell this story, which obviously means a lot to him to tell it, and he's such a great drummer that a guy that can drum like Keith Moon, you know, and we can watch that up close in a little theater, that's pretty thrilling.
Now, Mick, why does this show mean so much to you, and when did you become infatuated with Keith Moon?
Most Who fans end up latching on in their mid-teen years, and that's exactly what happened with me. I was listening to the radio, a song came on, it was The Who's new album, Quadrophenia, and within a month they were my favorite rock band, been that way ever since. The thing about the drumming in The Who, he's always improvising. He's always throwing in lots of stuff. He adds to the music, and even the songs were written around the drums. You can tell that a lot of the songs Pete Townsend wrote were for the drums, and he really makes the music come alive.
You being a New Orleans native, I have to ask this. Could folks expect to hear any New Orleans influence in the show?
Musically, yeah. Yeah, and you know, musically, it all comes from New Orleans, right? Mm-hmm. And it's in there. All of this rock and roll, all the Brits took everything from blues and from early rock and roll. Actually, there's, you know, I mentioned Little Richard a little bit with Earl Palmer. He played for Little Richard, and then he went out to Hollywood in L.A., and he recorded on a lot of the early rock and roll albums. So that's really the one kernel of New Orleans info. Earl Palmer is mentioned in the show.
Okay. Now, Nancy, you mentioned your inspiration behind directing this show, but let's talk about the rest of the production crew and some of the musical selections throughout.
Yeah, well, this came to me through Mick had the good fortune of having the rights, right, from Pete Townsend to use these songs, which is a big deal, and was even able, and he can explain it better, but it's like drum karaoke. Mick plays along with tracks of these songs minus the drums. Now, these are not the Who's album. They are recreations, but it's recorded using the same musical director that the Who's musical director did these recordings for us.
Yeah, the musical director of The Who is the musical director for the show.
Wow.
Frank Symes, yeah, and he helped us make the recordings. Yeah.
So that's cool. And then what I helped add to it when we first opened this piece in Mill Valley in California, in this version, and we've brought that here. So we have projections and some we get some other angles to see his drumming.
Overhead camera so you can see it from the top, so you can see all the details.
And these are in little, so far we've done these in very tiny little spaces. The challenge has been, how do you make it not punishing to the audience to sit in a tiny room listening to some rock and roll drumming?
One point, the Who were in the Guinness Book of World Records is the loudest rock band.
And I could believe it.
And we don't. So I have to confess, I do sometimes wear the earplugs in rehearsal when I have to hear it over and over and over. But the goal is to get it to the, and that's the challenge, and an interesting challenge from a technical perspective with our sound designers helping and our technical people to get it at the right kind of level, that it still feels like rock and roll, but no one's going to get hurt, right? Yeah. So you don't need earplugs for the show.
No, it's actually pretty comfortable because what we've got sound reduction heads and triggers on the drums, so the triggers go, put a sound into the PA, so we're able to control the volume of the drums. So it's actually, you can sit in the front row and it'll still feel comfortable to you. Took a lot of maneuvering to figure out how to pull that off.
This isn't the first time this show has been put on. You guys have done this show in California. Mick, this is the first time this show is being done down here. Excited about that, I'm sure.
Yeah. A lot of people I know are going to be coming. You know, it's funny because you get excited, but also the people that you know, that you really want them to like it, you know? So you really pour your heart out. And if it's a stranger who doesn't like it, you go, well, okay, I'll never see them again. But if it's your cousin, you go, okay, well, I got to live with this the rest of my life.
But then I have to keep reminding Mick, you know, because he always wants to please everyone. But if you're playing Keith Moon, you know, you got to screw everybody and just do what you want to do, right?
Right.
You have to be self-destructive.
Yes, I know. I'm trying, man. I'm trying. He's so clean. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I am clean. Yeah. And also, we've had to figure out a way to throw knives and explode a television. And we got that in the show. And the television was exploded, well, bashed by me. We took a cricket bat to a TV and we got it. We got it down. It's in there.
This show sounds like it's going to be exciting.
that's the idea.
And it kicks off tonight.
Come on down.
Yeah, to the Castle Theater, right?
Yeah. Kenner.
That was Mick Berry and Nancy Carlin. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim.
Keith Moon, The Real Me, will be performed at the Castle Theater in Kenner. Call 504-287-4707 for more information.
Just gotta be me.
Hey, did anybody notice the instrumentals for today's show are from Grammy nominees? One's Jay-Z and the other's Childish Gambino. And I can't forget about New Orleans native PJ Morton with this song.
Oh, PJ, you're not mainstream enough. Yeah. Would you consider us changing some stuff? Oh, like everything about who you are.
Congrats to all the Grammy nominees who were announced earlier this week. Be sure to catch the big awards show on the flat screen in your living room on January 28th. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? You can send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN
Thibodeau Homer. Thanks for joining us. Underwriting programming on WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio, is a great way to support this station, and it's also a very effective way to reach informed, civic-minded, and educated adults in the New Orleans region with information about your business, service, or organization. Find out how WWNO 89.9 FM can help grow your business by emailing underwriting@wwno.org.